As the number one audio company, iHeartMedia gives you access to all. Every audience, live conversations, trusted influencers, and the insights and data you need to grow. iHeartMedia is your access company. Go to iHeartResults.com for more.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV true crime podcast, To Live and Die in L.A. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world, and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
iHeart Podcast Update. This week on your free iHeartRadio app.
Fodor's Guide to Espionage, a 60s-era spy story of the world's first and greatest travel writer, Eugene Fodor, as he jet sets around the globe. Tongue Unbroken, Season 2. This podcast explores complex concepts of identity, resilience, erasure, and genocide. Table for Two, Season 2. Think of the show as a deconstructed Oscar party in podcast form. Each episode takes place over the romance of a meal and feels like you're seated next to a different guest at that dinner.
Hear these podcasts and more on your free iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Elliot Connie, and this is Family Therapy.
My best hopes, I guess, identify the life that I want and work towards it.
I never seen a man take care of my mother the way she needed to be taken care of.
I get the impression that you don't feel like you've done everything right as a father. Is that true?
That's true. And I'm not offended by that.
Thank you for going through those things, and thank you for overcoming them.
Thank God for the limits.
Every time I have one of our sessions be positive. It just keeps me going.
I feel like my focus is redirected in a different aspect of my life now.
So, how'd we do today?
We did good.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy. Listen now on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, hello, and welcome. This is Let's Talk About Myths, Baby. And I am your Medusa-obsessed host, Liv. We are truly in the golden age of mythological retellings. There are constant releases of new novels based on Greek myths, and frankly, it's pretty exciting. Pretty exciting for me, a person who just wants people to know more about myth, but also, you know, hey, if they find my podcast in the process, all the better. Of course, it's also a bit tricky for me, a person who speaks with authors about their novels and is asked by all of you amazing listeners whether I have read all of the varied novels. It's become one of those things where I actually have to turn down most because, as much as I think some of you might enjoy it, this podcast just isn't dedicated to speaking to fiction writers. I like to keep it primarily on the ancient sources and academics and their fascinating fields of expertise. And from a personal standpoint, I just can't have myth be every moment of every day of my life, so I don't have time to read most of these books. I have to go elsewhere. So as much as I would love to talk to every single person who's written a mythological retelling, let alone read them, it just cannot be done. There are, however, exceptions. Books where either because of the author or the way they have gone about the retelling, whatever it is, it means that I absolutely, without question, have to have them on my show. This is obviously one of those cases. Not only has Natalie Haynes been my favorite author of mythological retellings for quite some time now, but her latest was about Medusa. I mean, could I ask for anything more? Absolutely not. It is a novel by Natalie Haynes about Medusa. It is like she wrote it for me. So, of course, I sat down with Natalie Haynes to talk about all things Medusa and her novel Stoneblind. If you haven't read Stoneblind, not to worry. This is also just a fascinating look at Medusa and the characters that surround her, both directly and indirectly. But also, you should probably read Stoneblind. It's come out in North America this week, and it's already out in the UK and other areas, so check your local bookstores. With all of that said, and before we jump right into this conversation with Natalie Haynes, I do want to recognize that the publisher of this book in North America is HarperCollins US. Employees of HarperCollins US are currently on strike and asking for a fair contract. Not only do I support unions striking for better conditions and pay broadly, but as a person who started out in book publishing at one of the major publishers, and a person who knows just how much those employees get paid versus the work involved and the money publishers make, I absolutely and without question stand with the striking union of HarperCollins US. Conversations, bringing Medusa back to life with Stoneblind author Natalie Haynes. Well, thank you for doing this again. It's nice to speak with you again.
It's
been
like
2 years.
Has it really? I was trying to work out when it was, and I was like, no, I can't. I just can't do it.
Yeah. You were one of the first people I ever had on in like a conversation episode of my show, which is now something I do like all of the time. But amazingly, I started with you and Bettany Hughes. So it was it was like a very big start to that, but it's become a normal thing.
I love Bea. Bea is so great.
Yeah, no, it was very fun. It was quite the way to start out a new system of record, like just even having other people on my show. But I think started out with a bang and it went well. People really love it. So, but I mean, obviously I was happy to speak with you about any book, but Medusa is my like love of loves. So
it doesn't show from your tattoos at all. No interest there. It doesn't look like it.
Yeah, no, I don't have her anywhere. I mean, I'm absolutely fascinated by Medusa, and I'm just going to jump straight into talking about Stoneblind because the thing that really was so exciting to me is I think that, I mean, I have a lot of theories about Medusa that run through my head all the time. I've done like, I don't even know, 6 episodes on her probably, because there's always something new to theorize on. And I feel like you kind of distilled every theory that I have ever had about her into a novel in a really perfect way. So, I mean, it's right. Like everything I think about her, everything I use to like all the facts I use to defend her in any form that I need to, because weirdly it happens often, is like put into this book. A perfect way to start, I think, and also slightly rambly. So let me, like, before I go off on all of my theories that are in your book, how did you want to approach Medusa? Like, how do you think about her in terms of the ancient sources, and kind of what did you want your version of her to be?
Well, I decided I would write her novel when I had finished her chapter in Pandora's Jar. So I'd written a nonfiction chapter about her, thought about her essentially from the outside in quite an analytic way. And then after I finished that chapter, which is about, I don't know, 9,000 something words long, a friend of mine asked me what I was working on. And I was like, wah, 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 I'm so angry. And she was like, wow, I just don't know what's going to happen when you find out about the next 2,000 years of misogyny. So, an excellent point. Argh! And I thought, if I'm this cross after I've written all those words, I've got more to say. I'm not done here. So I knew I was coming in from a position of feeling really outraged for her. But considering how much I had already written about her, I was surprisingly not ready for the fact that when I came to it, there was so little literary material to go on. I had sort of blithely assumed that when I sat down to start writing Stoneblind, that it would be the same process as writing 1,000 Ships, which was very much basically, here are all your narratives. Some of them are theatrical, some of them are epic, some of them are, and I would just be choosing my way through what I wanted and what I thought would be most effective in the context, and, you know, inventing to fill in the gaps, essentially. And I suddenly realized that that would get me roughly, I don't know, 4 pages. And I was like, oh. And there were loads and loads of visual arts that I could use, of course, and do use extensively in the book. But that was just a really different process. I'd written about art in Pandora's Jar, again, from the outside, and I'd stolen the outfit that Themis is wearing in 1,000 Ships comes from a vase painting, for example. So I had done it before, but I didn't realize just how much more of a visual medium I would be working in while writing a novel. It's the first time I'd ever done it. And so it felt, at the beginning, I felt a bit untethered, you know? I was like, how am I gonna weigh this character down in time and place without a sort of a narrative backstory that everyone already trusts, even if they don't have it? And it was quite strange. And then I sort of realized, I wrote the first chapter where Medusa as a baby is sort of delivered to her sisters to look after. And I was like, okay, well, yeah, maybe this will, yeah. But almost immediately I realized I wanted it to be another polyphonic novel, that it wasn't going to be just a single. I had been so confident that this time I would break the habit of a lifetime of novel writing and make it one voice. And it was just within minutes, I was like, no, I can't do that, because I don't want to write it all in the first person. And I knew so hard that I wanted the voice of the Gorgonian to be in the first person. Mm. It literally never occurred to me it wouldn't be. And then, of course, there were so many other narratives that I could throw in, some of which work beautifully, I felt, in the third, like Danae's chapters. She's so sort of calm in the face of everything that's kind of lobbed at her. Telling her in a sort of close third person really worked. But if you think I could resist telling a story from the perspective of a chatterbox crow, no, it's like we haven't met. And the snooty olive trees, I mean, they were just so much fun to do.
Well, that leads into more questions, but I want to talk about Medusa more, especially because, I mean, Medusa is so fascinating because of what you're saying. Like, there are really so few, there are so few sources on her, but even in the few that we have, the actual details are like almost non-existent.
So skinny. Hesiod gives you a line in the Theogony.
Absolutely.
He says there are 3 Gorgons. Steno, Euryale, and Medusa, and the first 2 are immortal, and the 3rd one is mortal, and that's a wretched fate. That's it, dude.
Yeah, it's literally like
family saga is right here, and you've just put it in 4 words. What the hell is wrong with you?
She lay with Poseidon. She lay with Poseidon in a field of soft flowers and suffered a woeful fate. And you're like, that's all of it. That's the oldest surviving source we have on Medusa, and that's
turns
all
over
it
papyrus
says.
Looks again. It's like, what's going on?
Like,
so,
I mean,
Ovid's a longer version, but of course, Ovid is very much focused on the Perseus narrative, which is less interesting. What I found actually really interesting was when I came to properly think about there are 2 particular vase paintings that have a big secret starring role in this novel.
I feel like I can picture them.
One's in the Metropolitan Museum in New York, and you for sure can, because it shows Perseus in the act of decapitating Medusa. So his sword is literally curving around her neck. It's a it's a curved blade sword, a harpe. And she's asleep. You know, she's beautiful. She doesn't have snakes for hair. This is
the
5th century post. Yeah, so she's got this beautiful dark ringlets. Her eyes are shut, so they're just depicted with a tiny curved line for each one. And it just felt to me that it was a really ambivalent portrait of what's supposed to be, presumably, a hero overcoming a monster. You know, we see loads of vase paintings with Hercules doing exactly that. It always looks like he's having a whale of a time. You know, think of that fantastic pot where he's got brought the pig back for Eurystheus, and Eurystheus has got the panic on him, so he's decided to hide in a pot, which is painted onto the side of a pot for massive metatextuality. And Hercules is holding the pig over him, and it's sort of, it's not quite making a kissy kissy face, but it might as well be. He's sort of cowering away from it. It's like that vase painter is having fun. And what's more, Heracles is having fun. But you look at this vase painting of Perseus attacking Medusa, And it looks a lot like what it is, which is a young man decapitating a woman while she sleeps.
Mm-hmm. And he even looks like he's sneaking off.
He is.
Like,
he's on tiptoe.
Exactly.
So he absolutely looks sneaky.
It's so, yeah. And then isn't there like a, I don't know if it's the other side or there's one where then her head is in the bag. And
that one's in the British Museum.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. And it's really similar. Like her head's missing and it's in the kibbutz.
It's seconds later.
Yeah.
And the head is, as you say, stuffed into this bag. So again, the lack of humanity that he displays, in my view, I don't think you or I is the first person to notice this. I think those vase paintings look ambivalent because the painter was ambivalent. It is a difficult story. She's a goddess. She's in the theogony. You know, okay, she's mortal, so she's not technically a goddess, but she's part of a family of gods and goddesses. And so she makes her way. There are very few mortals in the theogony. Medea is also there, also mentioned as a daughter of someone connected to gods, granddaughter of the sun, I guess. Mm. So she is part of this god story, and she belongs there. And I think that probably explains why, you know, the wretchedness of her fate as far as Hesiod is concerned, is that because she's mortal, she can be killed. And therefore, when Perseus embarks on his slightly petulant quest to bring back the head of a Gorgon, it is Medusa who's clearly the target. But that doesn't suggest to me that there's approval going on.
Mm-hmm. No, I think, I think her story within Perseus is one of those ones where on the outside, we're expected to think of it as a heroic act. He's a hero. This is Greek mythology. But really, yeah, when you're in the sourcing, like, there's nothing to suggest that there's any good reason why he did this. It's one of the things I tell people all of the time in my daily life, probably to the point of annoyance, of just everything we think we know about Medusa as her, this monstrous thing, or like something that needed to be killed or required death or was like causing trouble. Like, all of that is an invention of the last however long, and all based in misogyny and entirely.
Surprise!
Yeah. Right. Like, some new and different for Greek mythology.
Text notes. Is this the first time that's happened? Wait, unfurls massive papyrus roll. No, turns out not.
Oh, wait. Is it what both of our careers are based off of? Like, yeah, it's one of those things. Like, and I just think even just the idea of why Perseus goes to kill her is so anticlimactic in this really interesting way of just, it isn't for any valiant reason. It's literally just an attempt to get him killed off. Like, it's just literally a thing that you know, that Polydectes thought was going to be impossible. And it's just so fascinating. And I've covered her in many different forms on the show, but I have another a book that's called, I think, The Medusa Reader, and it kind of breaks down all these different sourcing on her from the ancient world up until now.
But yeah, it's really, I honestly hold Ray Harryhausen's movie, The Clash of the Titans movie from 1980, whenever it is, one, I think, responsible for this, because in that version, then he goes on a noble quest to bring back the head of a Gorgon so he can kill a sea monster and rescue a princess. And it's like that. We understand how that narrative works. But of course, rescuing Andromeda is a side quest on the way home. In every ancient source that mentions it, it's incidental to the fact that he's gone to get the head of a Gorgon because a petulant man has asked him for one. Yep. And that's it. You know, there is nothing noble about it at all, actually. And I think that is hiding behind these vase paintings too, that what we can see is this isn't a, you know, you can see in the petulance of Eurystheus with that Heracles pot, that the payback for asking for a petulant thing is to be punished. And there he is cowering away. And so I feel like that same slightly, you know, judgmental attitude is in play when we see Perseus, you know, bravely conquering a monster. Well, how is she a monster? Because you don't like what she looks like. Oh, she's killed loads of people. Okay, name four. Oh, wait, what? She doesn't kill anyone until she's already been killed. I've never been able to find a convincing source that says so. No. So she's this great monster, and yet who does she kill? Well, once Perseus is using her head as a weapon of mass destruction, at one point, an entire island of people at a time, thanks to Ovid. We have that story from the Metamorphoses. But in terms of having agency and making the choice herself, where's this, you know, island covered in statues that we would expect her to live on? It doesn't exist.
Yep. Yeah, everything pre-Ovid is, I mean, that's another one. It's like, it's hilarious hearing all of these words come out of you, because I say these things all of the time. Yeah. Just like, she doesn't hurt anyone until her head is off of her body. Like, yeah, there is no evidence that she has ever harmed anyone in all of the ancient sources pre-Ovid. And yeah, it's she's just such an, it's so fascinating, because I'll go back to what you said about Clash of the Titans, though, because not only, I think, is you're right, is that responsible for this idea that like the heroic nature of his quest included that, or and the whole point was to save Andromeda, but I think it also gives her the monstrosity that we think of now too. Like, she is this, the idea of her being like echidna, like I feel like his version of her.
Definitely.
Yeah, it looks like what we think of as echidna. She's got this like snake bottom half.
Yeah, and long snaky tail. But exactly. No wings. Because he'd already done wings earlier in the movie with the harpies. Mm. I think he couldn't be bothered to do them again, which
yeah,
I respect
they would be
fully
difficult
as a choice. But yeah. I love the fact that snaky tailed Medusa from the Harryhausen has cast a long shadow, because Lego Medusa has a snaky tail. And it's like,
so many Medusas have that now. Like, as if it's canon. Yeah. It's fascinating.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, I don't particularly mind it. I love that there was a Ray Harryhausen exhibition in Edinburgh in the UK 2 years ago, I think. And it was quite chastening to discover that the model for Medusa was sort of, you know, like about a foot and a half tall.
Yeah.
It's like a sort of, you know, the most monstrous thing she might remind you of is a sort of slightly bad-tempered cat or something like that. It's like, oh, okay, it's not quite as scary now. But it is a brilliant depiction. But it's incredibly dehumanizing.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
I think loads of people remember it. I think that is the moment from Clash of the Titans where the skeletal warriors are in Jason and the Argonauts, the thing that gave people the heebs when they were a kid. And so I see it absolutely did its job correctly, but it's cast a long shadow. And so mm-hmm. people are very quick to think of her as a monster when, of course, she is a monstered woman. And worse than that, she is a monstered rape survivor. And an ignominious beginning to a long and continuing saga in which, when women speak out about harm done to them, they are rendered by society the outsider, the monster, the thing that has done things wrong. So I feel really strongly about her, that she should be reconsidered as in context, as a sister, as a daughter, and as a protector. Because the truth of the matter is, if you have the ability to turn things to stone with a single glance, and there are no named victims of you whatsoever, you must be trying really hard not to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I'm afraid, like the big soft-hearted person I am, it only makes me think that she is more lovable, more beautiful than before.
Oh, I agree entirely. Yeah, I spend a lot of my time defending her as whenever necessary.
Yeah.
But that leads to another really interesting point, and I'm curious what you think about it. So one of the things that I kind of stand by, and I recognize that it's not 100% explicit in the ancient texts, but is this idea, because a lot of people will claim that it's Ovid who invented the rape survivor narrative. And I would say that it is actually more present in Hesiod, not explicitly, but implicitly, due to the phrasing of how it happens, the words used, but also the fact that it's Poseidon. I think it's like, I mean, one, Hesiod doesn't really clarify in a lot of those cases like whether something is consensual, because he's just not really concerned with it, which I think does not imply that it was understood to be consensual in the ancient world. But also, like, Poseidon was almost never with somebody consensually, which I think you kind
sure.
of write into his character pretty strongly.
Yeah, I do.
Yeah, so like, I mean, what do you think of I guess Poseidon, but also, how do you consider it that Ovid invented this rape narrative, or that it's older?
No, I don't. I don't think it would have even occurred to Ovid to think in those terms particularly, because I'm afraid, much as we might like it to be different, the phenomenon of consent is a relatively recent one.
Mm.
And so I don't, you know, you can see the ugly arguments that this view of other human beings leads to in historical texts just as much as mythological ones. I'm thinking, I guess, of the Melian dialogue in Thucydides, where the debate is between, essentially, do we allow this city which has asked to become neutral to do that, or do we go there, kill all the men and enslave all the women and children, which is the Athenian punishment, and quite a used by other people too, not just the Athenians, across a long period of history. for revolt or treachery or whatever. And the Melians essentially say, don't do something as terrible as that, because basically one day you'll be on the receiving end of someone with more power. And don't you want to kind of set a precedent for being merciful?
Hmm.
And the Athenians offer a kind of might is right argument. It's presented to us essentially as a nomos versus phusis debate. So the law versus natural law. So the law is a road sign which says don't turn right. And you can obey that or not obey that. But if turning right takes you straight over a cliff, then gravity would be physics. So give it a go, see how it works out. And the Athenians essentially argue physics. They say it's in our nature as the stronger party to do whatever the hell we like, and it's the nature of the weaker party to put up with it. And although it's presented in a very kind of brutal and chilly way by the Athenians in this debate, I don't think it's a particularly unusual way of thinking. In the ancient world. Indeed, it probably isn't a very unusual way of thinking now, I'm afraid. So I don't think there's any question of thinking in terms of consent, in terms of sex, really, with either very young women, in the case of Medusa, or indeed very young men, in the case of Ganymede.
Mm-hmm.
Consent simply isn't, it just doesn't come up in our ancient sources. And until really recently, honestly, it wasn't coming up very much in classical scholarship either. You would get, I own books which sort of cheerfully defend the notion of being raped by a god, because usually something good comes of it, by which they mean usually a demigod child, or, mm-hmm. you know, you get to live quite a long time if Hera doesn't turn you into a, and so on and so on and so on. It's like, well, that, I'm going to have to stop you there and suggest that you think about this again. So I think it's really important that we reassess these texts within the values of our time. But I think there's a huge and important space between doing that and attributing our values to the past and assuming that characters created in the past could possibly have known what those values would be. People mm-hmm. who don't argue against slavery in the ancient world would include, for example, Jesus. So even by our standards, we would think, but surely everyone can agree that slavery is wrong. But it simply didn't occur to Aristotle to feel that way about it. And he was pretty smart. I think it's important that we retain this distinction. And the idea of consent, of course, when you live in a world with slavery, and I always say when I talk about slavery in the ancient world, because it's really important that we remember it, there are more slaves in the world now than there were in the ancient world. I do see we have a larger population now, but it is worth considering. When you live in a world which has slavery and doesn't question slavery, I think asking people to think about consent in any context mm-hmm. is probably, it's a step too far. You've already dehumanized huge chunks of the population. So of course you'll continue to do so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's interesting. It is fascinating the way, I mean, fortunately things are changing now, but yeah, I mean, I have a book of mythology that's like 20 years old, and the author, who is obviously a man, the way he describes what happens to Medusa and Athena's reaction is like one of the most horrifying things I've ever read, just in terms of like the level of disdain he has. And also like, it doesn't remotely, he's clearly describing the Ovid version, which I think Ovid is pretty clear that it's like a violent act.
Yes, he says by force. Yeah,
he's very like, this is not, you know, something that she liked. And this author rewrites it as something that Medusa did really intentionally, and like that Athena, you know, saw that. I don't know. It was really, it's interesting to me where I was like, you made it worse than Ovid. Like, you added misogyny that's not even in the ancient texts. And
that's incredibly common, I'm afraid.
Again, yeah.
The example I always give is the Odyssey, where Telemachus hangs the slave women who he and his father decide have been conspiring with the suitors. Although, of course, they are slaves, so they don't have consent. There is going to be no possibility of consent, because that's what it means to be an enslaved person.
Mm-hmm.
And when Emily Wilson's translation of the Odyssey came out, she accurately translated the line where he hangs them all from the same length of rope. She translates the word for these female slaves as the female slaves. The word in Greek is the word for slave in the plural and feminine, with the article in the plural and feminine to match the female slaves. And when I reviewed that excellent translation, I tracked down, I think, 4 or 5 different translations of the Odyssey from the 20th century, and I think one from the 21st. And every single one of them had translated it as harlots hussies, slatterns. I mean, it essentially had added in some misogyny to justify their hero Odysseus's behavior. It's like, well, it's a sufficiently disturbing piece of behavior that inspired Margaret Atwood to write the Penelopeiad. So, you know, I'm fine with us just acknowledging how horrible it is. And yet over and over again, you see that translators, I'm sure not from any kind of position of malice, just decided they should make it clear what Odysseus was really doing. Mm-hmm. Like, well, very well done for that, but we might call that editorializing. So, yeah, you know, it's a little bit more honest, I think, if you do it in a novel than in a translation. And obviously when I come to editorialize, for example, Perseus, or as you say, Poseidon, I think it's, you know, that it's in plain sight. It's right there. There's no point. I'm not pretending that this is a translation of a missing text found, you know, by me that mm-hmm. survives from the ancient world. I'm presenting you these myths, which I have been steeped in since I was 12 when I started studying Latin, 14 when I started studying ancient Greek. So I've spent my whole adult life and then some here. And it's like, but I am also alive now in the 21st century and steeped in the feminism of my mother and all our foremothers. So yeah, this is the text you're going to get from me.
Mm-hmm.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV true crime podcast, To Live and Die in LA. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
iHeart Podcast Update. This week on your free iHeartRadio app. Fodor's Guide to Espionage, a 60s-era spy story of the world's first and greatest travel writer, Eugene Fodor, as he jet sets around the globe. Tongue Unbroken Season 2. This podcast explores complex concepts of identity, resilience, erasure, and genocide. Table for Two Season 2. Think of the show as a deconstructed Oscar party in podcast form. Each episode takes place over the romance of a meal and feels like you're seated next to a different guest at that dinner. Hear these podcasts and more on your free iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Elliot Connie, and this is Family Therapy.
My best hopes, I guess, identify the life that I want and work towards it.
I never seen a man take care of my mother the way she needed to be taken care of.
I get the impression that you don't feel like you've done everything right as a father. Is that true?
That's true. And I'm not offended by that.
Thank you for going through those things, and thank you for overcoming them.
Wow. Thank God for the limits.
Every time I have one of our sessions be positive. It just keeps me going.
I feel like my focus is redirected in a different aspect of my life now.
So, how'd we do today?
We did good.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy. Listen now on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Get emotional with me, Radhi Devlukia, in my new podcast, A Really Good Cry. We're going to talk about and go through all the things that are sometimes difficult to process alone. We're going to go over how to regulate your emotions, diving deep into holistic personal development, and just building your mindset to have a happier, healthier life. We're going to be talking with some of my best friends.
I didn't know we were going to go there on this.
People that I admire.
When we say listen to your body, really tune into what's going on.
Authors of books that have changed my life.
Now you're talking about sympathy, which is different than empathy, right?
And basically have conversations that can help us get through this crazy thing we call life.
I already believe in myself. I already see myself. And so when people give me an opportunity, I'm just like, oh, great, you see me too.
We'll laugh together, we'll cry together, and find a way through all of our emotions. Never forget, it's okay to cry as long as you make it a really good one. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Radhi Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, that, I mean, brings up some important characters that I'd love to talk about, too. I mean, broadly, I think I really enjoy your use of Poseidon and Zeus. So I'm curious, like, I mean, they're just sort of the versions I think of them in terms of their behavior. But how did you want to go about handling any of the gods, I would say, and Perseus, too? Like, what was your sort of intention with all
of
them?
It was a lot of fun to do, actually, because I realized that I was thinking of those, that vase painting, the one you mentioned with the Kibisis that's in the British Museum, is a case in point, really, but the one in the Met just as much, where he's wearing winged sandals. Those have been borrowed from Hermes. He's wearing a winged hat. That's the cap of darkness that belongs to Hades. It looks like it's Hermes's hat, but it is not, at least according to our literary sources. It's Hades's that he's wearing. Mm-hmm. So shoes from Hermes, hat from Hades. The Kibisis is a loan from the Hesperides. It's a sacred item carrier, so it's gold and silver tassels, so it's much stronger than a regular bag. The sword, the harpe, belongs to Zeus. Again, it's a loan from the Hesperides. And on the Met vase, although he doesn't have the backpack on that version, he is looking behind him and consulting with Athene, who's behind him. So it's like, well, there are five different gods or sets of gods involved in this process of decapitation. And there are two ways of looking at this, and I think probably both of them are true. The first, of course, is to say this young man is incredibly favored by the gods, because look at them all queue up to help him. You know, this is truly a son of Zeus, because all these other gods are offering him assistance. But the other way of looking at it, and equally valid, is just how useless is this young man that so many gods have to help him? How much help does Heracles have when he's off on all his tasks? Almost none at all. If anything, he's got hindrance, because Hera is hurling further obstacles at him constantly. And whenever she gets the chance, even if it's the weather, she'll do it. So, yeah, you know, and yet he still manages to complete all these labors pretty well, not entirely, but pretty well single-handedly. And, you know, job done, thanks very much. Perseus needs all these deities to assist him. Well, that speaks to me of a man who is rather helpless. So the fun thing about writing him was trying not to make him helpless, because contrary to the response of some of my readers, I don't think he is helpless, actually. The problem is that we always see him in context, almost always see him in context with Athene. When we see him in the context of his mother, he doesn't seem anywhere near as helpless. And similarly with Andromeda, when she sees him, she doesn't see him as someone helpless at all. But most of the way through the book, we see him as he is in some kind of scene with Athene and with Hermes. And asking them to understand his motivation in anything is like asking you or me to understand what an ant thinks. These are gods that live on Mount Olympus. Their lives are so long, so unmeasurable, so uncuttable, that our lifespan is just like blinking to them. So what on earth would be the point in trying to understand how humans do anything? What would be the point? They'll be gone in a minute. You know, I've just literally just heard you say, I don't want to do it, like, and then now you're dead. So what difference does it make? And so he and she don't understand each other at all. And the delight of writing those scenes, which I think are some of the funniest scenes in the book, was being able to have this total clash of understanding. He can't possibly hope to understand her. She's a deity. She can't be bothered to try and understand him. He's just a puny mortal. So this total culture clash was, I mean, it was just a lot of fun to write, because it made me, once I'd realized that the joy would be in trying to work out what he didn't know, and when he would reveal this ignorance to gods who just assume everyone knows everything all the time, because why wouldn't you? Those scenes were all fun to write.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can definitely, you can tell you had fun writing those ones, and particularly, like, I think just Athena broadly, because her character.
Yeah, I did.
Yeah,
I've got no poker face at all, at all. And you can hear every time I'm typing. You can, and on the audiobook, you can hear it even worse. I'm, you know, I know that people's response to Athene is going to be quite layered, because sometimes she's really funny, sometimes she is, you know, the perpetrator of absolute horror, mm-hmm. and sometimes she's the recipient of horror. And so I don't really like trying to delineate people into, you know, this person's a villain, this person's a hero, this person's a victim. It's like an awful lot of people can be all of those things at different times in their life, and sometimes more than one of those things at the same time. And so I had an absolute ball writing her, which makes me feel a bit guilty, really. but, you know, it is what it is, huh?
I mean, she is so fascinating, though, because she is such a complex character. And, like, and I think what you just, how you just described all of that, though, the characters who can be so many different things, that's so especially true for Greek mythology, because, and this is something I say so often on the show, but, like, you know, that these stories weren't developed in the way that we develop stories now. They didn't have the same intention, same background, any of that. And so, like, they weren't, I mean, other than the heroes, which even their version of what heroes were is different from what we would think of today. But other than even, say, them, like, everyone is just serving their own purpose in each one of the stories. Like, no one is inherently good all the time, and no one is inherently bad all the time. I think about this a lot when, you know, so many pop culture reception, various things when it comes to Greek myth are always making Hades the villain.
Absolutely,
and
it, right.
Yeah, yeah, and it's like he's never the villain in Greek myth.
Yeah,
like,
well, because he's been, again, I'm afraid, tainted by Christian thinking that, mm-hmm. you know, the God who lives in the underworld must be the devil because it's the same thing as hell. And the fact that there are the Elysian fields as well, it's like, it's everyone's underworld, mate. Mm-hmm. Honestly, unless you get actually deified and go hopping up to Mount Olympus, it's everyone's underworld. But we're determined to make him evil. So, and sometimes that really plays to a strength. So it works incredibly well, I think, in Disney's Hercules, mm-hmm. because, you know, you've got James Woods. Why wouldn't he be evil? That's exactly what we've all turned up for. But other times, yes, I agree. You're just like, you understand that he's okay, nothing, never mind. Yes. Doesn't matter. We'll talk another time.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think Athena is such a good character for that. And I think she appears that way really strongly in your book, where you're like, she's fun, she's funny, she's really dry in a way that, like, she's got quite a unique personality, but also she does horrible things because she's a Greek goddess, and, like, there's horrible things that happen in mythology, and it doesn't make the character bad. It just makes them a god or just part of a Greek myth.
I mean, she's completely amoral, and yeah. all my versions of Greek gods are amoral. And I don't think that's my invention. I think it goes back to at least the Iliad, mm-hmm. you know, where mm. the Homeric gods are completely amoral, incredibly petty. When I used to teach this a very long time ago, I just say they're like superpowered toddlers. They don't want or not want anything with any grandeur at all. It's entirely petty every single time. And yet they want it with a profundity that you and I can only begin to dream of, because we can only want something really, really intensely for a few months, weeks, years, whereas they can do it for millennia. So, you know, our feelings obviously are going to be more intense. And you get that, I think, with Perseus responding to Athena in particular, but Hermes as well, is that he, you know, the petulance in him, it comes from, I think, just an absolute sense that he's not being heard, that he's not understood. And of course, you know, he's a doted on child by his mother and his sort of honorary grandfather. And so he's used to being heard. And the terrible pain of going from that to being just absolutely ignored, I think it comes across in him as petulance, but it's a quite a profound psychological scar. So yes, but as the book progresses, I think he, in some ways, he becomes more like Athene in ways that I don't think she would have ever noticed, and I didn't intend when I was writing it, but I realized once I'd finished it, when I did the audiobook recording, I was like, so sometimes these things happen.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things that was sort of surprised me reading it, and it plays into what you mentioned about how you attempted or thought for a moment of doing a book that was just in one point of view and then decided to go with
never
so many more. No, fair enough. So you fit in so many different points from mythology, like far more than I was expecting. Like Gigantomachy comes to mind as the most obvious.
Oh man, that was fun to do.
Yeah,
that
I bet.
It was all based on the Pergamon altar in Berlin.
Yeah.
And so at the risk of destroying the magic, then I was writing that chapter in January, I think, of 2021. And I had begun it and I wanted to write it closely based on the Pergamon altar with some necessary changes, which I won't today discuss because I don't want to spoil the end of the book. And it's a long time since I'd been in Berlin and we couldn't travel. You know, Britain was in lockdown. Mm-hmm. Germany was in lockdown. The museums were shut anyway. And Britain had just, in its many spasms of leaving the EU, had finally done that. And so, there was just these huge problems with trying to transport goods in and out of Europe to the UK because we'd suddenly added like 10 million pieces of paperwork to it. And I was like, well, I really wish I could see these pictures up close. But I, you know, the pictures that I took, it's so long since I was last there, they were on a film camera. You know, they're probably at my mom's house. That's no good. I don't want her to go to the post office. You know, she's not as young as she was. Sorry, mom. And so I was like, and there were no detailed close-up pictures online that I could find. Mm. And I found this incredible looking book that I really, really wanted. And it looked like it had really good close-up photographs in it. And I thought, well, I'll order it from the museum. And by the time it turns up, I'll probably have finished the scene. But I can go back and make changes later and that will be okay. And so I ordered it from a closed museum in a locked down country to be sent across a newly erected trade border where things were being, you know, delayed for weeks at a time to another locked down country. And it was here 48 hours later.
Oh my gosh.
This has gone surprisingly well, everybody. So yeah. I just sat here like, oh my God, thank you. And so the details of that sequence, the gigantomachy, are all taken from the Pergamon altar. I had to track down a place in Phlegra which is one of the locations given for the gigantomachy. So I found a place with pictures online, because obviously I couldn't travel to Greece either, that looked like it would be a good scene for a gods versus giants battle. And so it all came from there.
Oh, that's wonderful. So did you always want to like cover as many myths as you could sort of fit into the narrative, or did that come up as you were writing?
I wanted to cover as much of Medusa's story as I could, and I knew the right way to do that very quickly wasn't just to focus on her and her sisters, but was to expand the narrative accordingly. And of course I'd done that with ships, which seemed like a more, you know, plausible version of that, because you knew straight away you'd have the Greeks, the Trojans and the gods if you wanted them. Mm-hmm. But with Medusa, it's like, well, what happens if we take this story and it's all focused on this single person? And very quickly it became clear that Athene would be a sort of antagonist, or a dual protagonist, I suppose, if you prefer. And that then the story of how her character develops would become, in some ways, as important as how Medusa's develops. And so there were just so many voices to include, but the majority of the extra voices come from Athene's life story rather than just from Medusa's. But if somebody is your nemesis, to use it in its modern rather than its Greek goddess term, we need to know why. You know, it's not good enough to just say, as a, you know, ancient Greek man writer would have said, and indeed did say, oh, and then Athene was angry with her, and so this. It's like, well, that's not going to cut it here. This is a novel now. It's not just a poem. I can't just dazzle you with my beautiful metrical arrangements and then move on to something else, Ovid style. This requires actual cause and effect. So I wanted to show you both of them in the round, and as many of the characters as I could really in the round. And even, you know, Perseus, who is not a particularly sympathetically drawn character, I think he still deserved his context. You know, Danae needed to be brought into the story, from my perspective anyway, to explain Perseus, because really his redeeming feature is that he cares about his mother. Mm-hmm. And that's not the worst thing anyone's ever done. So I didn't want to miss out any of those parts of the story. And then generally, just when I was thinking, you know, is this too much? Are there going to be too many people? Then something like a chatterbox crow would turn up and I'd be like, oh, everyone's going to let me have this one. No one's going to make me cut this one out. This is going to be too much fun. So, yeah, they all sort of, they all felt necessary as I went along to illuminate the story sort of as fully and as roundly as I could.
Well, and once you'd have that many, like it seems like you might as well add more, especially when they come up naturally. Like I really enjoyed the snakes, you know, suddenly we're getting individual snakes perspective in her hair. I was curious because you used so much Greek in there, whether like even your publisher or anyone else was worried that people weren't,
they
or
weren't.
It was going to take too long to figure out they were the snakes.
Yeah, no, there weren't. I mean, there's in the UK version, there's a snake that goes down the page, a drawing of a snake on the page. And I guess I don't know if that will be in the American version because I haven't seen a finished copy yet. Mm-hmm.
It's not in the ARC, I can tell you. But that's the advance, so it probably wouldn't be.
But. Yeah, so I don't know. But it does, they are mentioned in the list of characters at the front, which I think will have survived the journey. But again, I haven't seen a finished copy, so I don't know. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, it's always a risk. It's always a risk that people won't guess something. But I would much rather be baffled than bored as a reader and as a viewer. So I think by that point, people will probably trust me. But, you know, we'll see. The crow has the good grace to announce itself, of course. Like, hello, I'm a crow, basically. And the snooty olive trees similarly they sort of reveal their characters quite quickly. Mm-hmm. But it was just irresistible to me to keep. You know, I thought I would spend more time with the Andromeda storyline, I think, than I did, because such big things happen to her, but they're so big, they sort of defy too many pages. It's like it would throw the novel off center. So her story is told in the third to give it again that slight distance, because, you know, she's a smart cookie, I think, Andromeda. She makes a good play through the book, and I felt like she deserved the chance to, you know, make choices that improved her prospects as far as she was concerned. I mean, obviously my opinion of her choices is that she'd be better off adjourning to a nunnery, but, you know, anachronistically, but fair, I think. So yes, I guess she could have gone off and become a servant of Artemis or something.
Yeah, that might have been a little bit better, but you know.
You know, I'm not gonna tell her how to live. I've done enough of that by writing a novel. So yeah, she's allowed to do whatever she likes after the end of the pages.
Yeah, no, and I'm curious to see the finished copy in North America. And obviously we'll be buying one. The use of, I mean, there was just so much in there as somebody who obviously like knows all the myths like the back of my hand. It was so interesting to see so many different ones, including, you know, the Hephaestus and Athena bit with the birth of Erichthonius, and just the way you kind of incorporated so much of her story to explain Athena like as a character was very interesting and unexpected.
The hardest thing to do actually in the whole, technically it was the hardest thing to do, was to impose a timeline on a god. And it hadn't really occurred to me just how necessary it would be. Mm-hmm. And therefore how difficult it would become. But in the end, I couldn't write the first of the Athene chapters until because there are all these stories about her that appear in all these different sources, never all together in the same place, often within the same poem or even the same visual artwork. They are self-contradictory. You know, she is holding or wearing a thing that she will acquire as a result of the thing that she's currently doing. And it's like, oh, I have a question. No, never mind. Doesn't matter. And so she was extremely difficult at first to work out. And then in the end, I basically just made a huge list of, you know, cool stories that Athene is in, things that she does, things that are done to her, things that she is interested in, and so on, that were from the grandeur and scale of the Gigantomachy to this tiny little reference that she is the goddess who invents the flute. And I went through this huge long list of stuff, and then basically I picked the stories that I thought were most important, most integral to the Medusa story, some of which were easy because they contained them both, and some of which were more difficult because I felt they would illuminate it in a different way. And then I imposed an order and said it goes this way, and at that point it all suddenly became much more manageable. Because, you know, obviously some of her scenes are with Perseus, so his timeline dictates those, but they can't contradict hers. And it is virtually impossible to find an ancient artwork where any kind of coherence is even attempted on the subject of the gods and what they do. Because, of course, you know, it's the perfect illustration. These stories bubble up across 2,000 years and across many, many thousands of miles. And so, of course, they are contradictory. So imposing any kind of order on Athene felt like a slightly blasphemous goal, but it was worth it, I think.
Yeah, it's always my first recommendation to people when they're trying to understand Greek myth is like, don't try to figure out a timeline. It's only going to hurt you, and it's going to be more confusing than is necessary.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes it's really satisfying. Like the people who spend all their time looking at the timelines of the Odyssey, where, you know, mm-hmm. there are flashbacks within flashbacks. It's fantastically complicated and really good fun. But man, you are onto an absolute loser if you try to do that. You know, there's a moment in the Odyssey where Circe says to Odysseus, oh, you know, don't go through those wandering rocks, I think, because Jason went that way and he only got through because Hera helped him. And you're like, okay, great, so now I know the Argonautica is before. And so sometimes when there are human beings involved, you can impose an order, but it will always betray you. Mm-hmm. You will always find yourself suddenly painted into a corner going, no, hang on a minute.
Well, I think about that a lot too with Athena and Hephaestus, because there is also narratives around Hephaestus being born of Hera because she was mad that Zeus had Athena, but then Hephaestus helps Zeus birth Athena, and you're like, well, what are we supposed to do with this?
Yeah, yeah. Well, thank goodness they're immortal, because otherwise this would be incredibly confusing.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, I mean, you're right. Of course, these things are completely circular. It's the Ouroboros, isn't it? It's, it's a snake eating its own tail. And you do just have to impose an order. And I'm reasonably careful to not let the gods get ever involved in the idea of time. You know, occasionally I'll be like, oh, this is quite pressing. Why? That kid that is technically yours is about to drown. But they can either do really imminent or forever.
Yeah.
And other than that, I don't really allow them to get too tangled up in time. In a way, it was a much more central theme of the book than I expected it to be, because I thought the theme of the book, when I read that chunk in Hesiod, I thought the theme of the book would be mortal versus immortal. You know, Medusa is mortal, her sisters are immortal. How will that be for them? And almost immediately it became clear that the thing that would be important in their relationship wouldn't be they know that she can die and she knows that they can't, but would be she experiences change and they don't. Because it's a necessary corollary of immortality, I think, that you're unchanging. And the Gorgons are a lot less lofty than the Olympians, literally and metaphorically. They live on Earth. They are creatures of the sea, the sky, and the land where they live, but their parents are sea gods and they have wings. So they're completely liminal creatures. And they are still, Euryale and Steno are still obviously immortal and unchanging in a way. But then the tension of the book came with, well, what happens if you give those goddesses a mortal creature to care for? Mm-hmm. And the answer is they learn to change, because that's what love means. And so they gradually, and you know, neither of them wants it, and yet it happens to them just the same. They learn exactly what love means, even though they didn't particularly intend to, because they realize they're frightened for her when she gets hurt. And that's what it means to be mortal.
Mm-hmm.
I'm Elliot Connie, and this is Family Therapy.
My best hopes, I guess, identify the life that I want and work towards it.
I never seen a man take care of my mother the way she needed to be taken care of.
I get the impression that you don't feel like you've done everything right as a father. Is that true?
That's true, and I'm not offended by that.
Thank you for going through those things, and thank you for overcoming them.
Wow, thank God for the limits.
Every time I have one of our sessions be positive. It just keeps me going.
I feel like my focus is redirected in a different aspect of my life now.
So, how'd we do today?
We did good.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy. Listen now on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
iHeart Podcast Update. This week on your free iHeartRadio app.
Fodor's Guide to Espionage, a 60s-era spy story of the world's first and greatest travel writer, Eugene Fodor, as he jet sets around the globe. Tongue Unbroken Season 2. This podcast explores complex concepts of identity, resilience, erasure, and genocide. Table for Two Season 2. Think of the show as a deconstructed Oscar party in podcast form. Each episode takes place over the romance of a meal and feels like you're seated next to a different guest at that dinner.
Hear these podcasts and more on your free iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV True Crime Podcast. to live and die in LA. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and I'm back for another season of my podcast, Climbing in Heels. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as fully obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. My podcast, Climbing in Heels, is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season, we're taking things up a notch. I'll be talking to some incredible women across so many industries, from models and beauty industry stars to doctors, entrepreneurs, and TV personalities. Climbing in Heels is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Every week, listeners will be able to ask me any questions. I'm answering it all. My life is absolutely crazy with so much going on, and I'm so beyond excited to bring you along for the ride. Whether we're talking red carpet looks, current trends, or products I'm obsessed with, I'm here to be your fashion fairy godmother. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And so it turned out to be much, much more about the passage of time than I realized. But perhaps that's just because I'm getting so old. Can't quite tell.
I mean, also writing it in a pandemic means that time has become like a baffling thing to navigate. Like,
yeah, like an accordion, right? Where sometimes it's really, really long between mm-hmm. 2 points. And then sometimes they're right next to each other. You're like, dude, stop doing that.
Yeah.
No one even wants to hear the accordion. Now stop it. But yeah, that's how it feels.
Yeah, yeah. Well, so that brings up another thing that I find so interesting about Medusa and was really satisfied by how you handled it. But the idea of her being this mortal with an immortal family has always, I mean, it is just inherently fascinating. And I've always kind of wondered whether there was any thought process behind it in the ancient Greek world, like whether they tried to ever navigate why that would be, because it feels to me like either there's this big reason that we don't know, or it's just explicitly to allow Perseus to kill her, but that also feels too simple. And so, I mean, how did you approach like explaining why she would be this like singular mortal character?
I don't think I did, really. Okay. I basically treat her as though she is a mutant.
Yeah.
That's essentially the mindset that I had. Mm. It's like, well, what would happen if you had a sibling who was just somehow weirdly different from you?
Right.
And at the moment, I can literally hear metaphorically hear the voice of my big brother sniggering right now and saying, yeah, we've all had to live through that. But what do you do when that happens, when that sibling mm. comes along? And I think a lot of the time, we're so bamboozled by the people we're closest to. They're so utterly other than us, even as we grow up in the same world. And my brother has a fantastically good memory for our childhood. I can remember almost nothing. So when I need to know about what it was like when we were kids, I have to ask him. And then when he says it, I'm like, oh yeah, of course, that's right. But I haven't remembered it on my own. So, you know, we have this completely different way of approaching even our own kind of communal memory, quite aside from anything more external than that. So I think perhaps it is just the case that everybody ends up feeling that way about the people they're closest to, that they also could not be further away. You know, those boundaries between us exist, even though there are times with the people we love when they just dissolve. And it's like we're inside each other's hearts, or we're inside each other's minds. I know everything that you're thinking right now. You know, my brother and I can't play charades with other people because we win so fast, it's just embarrassing. And yet, you know, we have this completely different outlook on life. Mm-hmm. And so I think, I wish I could explain it to you in a sort of mythos sense, why there would be this distinction drawn. My guess is that it doesn't come up at all until relatively late, which is, you know, when Perseus comes into the story, that originally and archaeologically, we can see Gorgonea, these Gorgon heads, all over the place in mm-hmm. the ancient Greek world. And that's not particularly unusual, because heads and sort of grotesque heads, particularly somewhere between a mask and a face, they're drawn by everybody. You know, all cultures have these kinds of masks or extreme faces, as far as I can tell. And, you know, even if you give a kid a piece of paper and a yellow pen, they'll draw the sun and it will have a smiley face, and it will have, you know, those sort of emanating rays like a lion's mane, exactly like a Gorgon would look if you asked them to draw one of those, I suspect. Mm-hmm. And so I think most probably what happens is that we get these Gorgonea, these protective heads. They're apotropaic, I think, from their locations. They're not just designed to be scary, they're also designed to protect. Mm-hmm. Much like the evil eye is used now in jewelry, or, you know, key rings or whatever in Greece or in Turkey. And then the bodies come secondarily. We get Gorgons a little bit later than we get these original, often, as I say, quite monstrous heads. The heads, I think, are designed as a sort of emblem or talisman against the fears of the natural world. The very wide mouth with the lolling tongue represents the noise of thunder, perhaps. The massive snakes looks like, you know, snakes, but also like a lion's mane. The tusks, obviously, reminiscent of wild boar. So lots of things that can kill you in ancient mm-hmm. Greece. So I think the heads exist as a sort of reflection of contemporary fears, or a manifestation of contemporary fears, in order to make them a bit more manageable. Mm-hmm. And then they're followed by bodies, which have to be a bit monstrous, because look at the faces, so they get wings. And then I think, probably, and I can't prove it, but I believe it, that, you know, people said, well, how come we've got all these heads separated from these bodies? We must need somebody with a sword. Mm-hmm. And that's Perseus's role in the story. So, but then by the time we have a long form narrative version of it, which is Ovid, you know, this story's been going around for hundreds of years by then. And so, you know, there's mention of the Gorgon head in the Iliad and one in the Odyssey. Mm-hmm. So it's already hundreds of years old. And then at that point, it's like, oh, well, you know, now we need this hero to have a monster to overcome. Like, well, that's not the way I see it, I'm afraid. I see it as us needing a man with a sword to separate a head from a body. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's generally so interesting to compare the Gorgonea, those images of just the heads, with then Hesiod's version or take on it, where he explicitly says that one was mortal. And then to get to the pottery that we talked about at the beginning, where, you know, other than the wings, she's so inherently human. And
well,
I also
because she goes through the same beautification process in the 5th century that art mm-hmm. in the Greek world generally does. So if you see earlier pieces of mm-hmm. her, she looks much stranger and more extreme or grotesque. Mm-hmm. She gets prettified in the 5th century, like everybody gets prettified mm-hmm. in the 5th century, which in a way is great because you get beautiful art. And in a way, of course, it's horrible because it betrays a mindset which says that people are good on the outside if they're good on the inside, and vice versa. But I mean, of course, that does in turn reveal that Medusa is presumably meant to be a beautiful human being when mm-hmm. we see her painted on a vase looking like a beautiful young girl, because mm-hmm. we know for sure this is happening in a time when beauty is seen as being an external beauty is seen as a reflection of your internal good character. You know, you can see that in, oh, which Plato dialogue is it? The Hippias Major, I think, when they talk mm-hmm. about beauty. And gloriously he says at one point, beauty is difficult. It is difficult. Yeah, really good point. So yeah, but if you look at some of the, there is a beautiful, beautiful Gorgon at the Archaeological Museum in Corfu, which I think is 6th century BCE, and it's huge. It's the pediment from the Temple of Artemis, so it's about 13 meters across. I can't do that in yards. I'm so sorry, America, but it's vast. And I knew this because I'd written about it in Pandora's Jar, and yet still, when I walked around a corner and saw it, I didn't even gasp. I laughed out loud. She's massive. And this version of her, she's so strong. She's like muscly arms. They're cycling. Her legs are cycling. She's got, you can't see much of the wings because I think it's sandstone that it's made of, and it hasn't survived beautifully. But you can see a few feathers lurking behind her. So her arms are pumping. She's probably flying rather than running, but the muscles in her legs are absolutely incredible. Mm-hmm. And the thing I love about her most is that, actually, She's got this amazing belt made of winding snakes, which is just beyond cool. But additionally, on top of all of this, so she's properly, she looks like a deity. She looks super other. She could not look stranger or more like she's undergoing her epiphany, which I think is probably what we're supposed to think. And she's got these beautiful round cheeks, little chubby cheeks. And just like in Pindar, when he calls her Yuparu, you know, she's got beautiful cheeks, Medusa. You're like, she does have beautiful cheeks. And because I'm really lucky and I don't only view beauty through the prism of people I would like to have sex with at some point, I can see that this monstrous god is beautiful and it's not difficult to see at all.
Well, I always think of those, I think they're 6th century, the Boeotian pottery. Where
right, with the horses. Yeah, the horse bodies.
No, there's ones where it's her sister is like protecting her and Medusa's head is already off and there's like a tiny Pegasus coming off of her neck.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Yeah, they're like very black figure and very unique looking. And I just love that one because the sisters are so clearly protecting her. It's too late, but they're like, you can see the fury directed at Perseus and he's like running away like a little coward and they're just they're such beautiful pieces. But the way they visualize the Gorgons is this, it's almost like a combination of that beauty and, you know, quote unquote monstrosity. By that I just mean not human, because their bodies are pretty human but their heads, like the snakes, it's as if they have like three big snake hair.
I tend to go with extreme as the word to describe them, and sometimes grotesque, but the same things are present in this pediment in Corfu, because she is still alive or perhaps immortal. You know, it does look like an epiphanic image from art that we see in the ancient Near East. So perhaps at this point she's become a goddess, but she for sure still has her head because it's attached to her body. And yet on either side of her, she is flanked by her own offspring, by Pegasus and Chrysaor, who are traditionally born from her severed neck as the children of Poseidon, something which I excluded from my telling of it because I thought it was probably a step too far into weirdness for a non very nerdy audience, which is, you know, don't get me wrong, I'm here for the nerds all day long, but I felt like I didn't want to make things just unreasonably difficult. But yeah, I mean, she is shown therefore in this extraordinary setting as being supremely powerful. As I say, she seems to have transcended mortality at this point and have become a goddess. The belt, I'm told by the very brilliant theologian Francesca Stavrakopoulou, Professor Francesca Stavrakopoulou, the snake belt is a symbol of great power of a god or goddess in the ancient Near East, which is her specialist area. And there we see her with her offspring.
That's really lovely.
It's an extraordinary piece. And then also she has a leopanther, you know, those lovely somewhere between a leopard and a panther or a lion and a panther, cats on either side of her. And they've got the most beautiful swirly fur. I cannot recommend it enough.
I have to go to Corfu.
You honestly do. I'm so sorry for your loss.
Oh yeah, it'll be so difficult.
Another burden to carry.
Greece, it's so difficult to travel there. I never want to. Yeah, I love that because I love this. I mean, I don't want to say I love the story of Pegasus, but I love that Pegasus is her child. It's unfortunate, you know, the only way that he gets born is once her head is gone. So it is so nice to have a version where she is
alive. Where they're contemporaneous.
Yes. Yeah. Like where she actually knows that she has children at all.
Yeah.
And it was interesting to me that you left that part out. And I do think you're right. Like I couldn't imagine weaving it into that part of the story because it ends up like it's not comedic, but it's difficult to not present
it. It's really hard to do it any other way. It is really interesting that there are moments which you don't notice until you come to write them where you're like, oh yeah, this can't possibly work outside of the context of ancient poetry because it's just too weird.
Exactly.
And, you know, sometimes sometimes as a classicist, you sort of forget because none of it seems weird. You've been talking about it for so long.
And then or all like, of
no. it. Yeah, exactly. And then you're like, oh no, hang on. Yeah, sorry, this is actually quite weird. And, you know, sometimes it takes another person to notice it because you don't. But that time I knew immediately that it would. I'd written about that part of her life as a mother, albeit an imminently deceased mother in Pandora's Jar, and I knew it wasn't going to fit into Stone Blind, but it goes that way sometimes. You know, I really wanted to write about Hermione in A Thousand Ships as Helen's daughter. There's an unbelievably beautiful and tragic Ovid poem about her. And it just did not fit. It just took the focus too far forwards in time. And then it meant wrenching it back instead of taking you back. You know, that narrative is supposed to sort of lap over you like waves. And I just couldn't make it work. I had to jettison it. These things happen.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I mean, yeah, with Pegasus, I think. I do also think you kind of left it almost, if I'm recalling correctly, but like it's almost like it could have happened, we just don't know about it. Like it's not like it was sort of explicitly
ruled out for you.
Yeah.
No, it's generally with my writing, it's full of Easter eggs for big myth nerds or classics nerds or both.
I think I found them all.
Yeah, I would say you should probably get a special egg to register this, I think. But yeah, I don't very often, I'm much more likely to make a little oblique hat tip to something than I am to cut it out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think, no question, this is the book I've read that has the most mythology inside it, or most that I'm like, I think it also proved to me just how long I've now been doing this and how much I'm steeped in myth, because I was like, oh, there's not a thing in this that I did not know happened in a really satisfying way, where I was like, I think I might know mythology fairly well. Like,
yeah, here you go.
Yeah, it was proving to myself quite a bit. Well, I mean, God, Medusa is just, I could definitely talk about her forever. And I'm just trying to think of, are there any other characters that you really were thrilled that you were able to include or really enjoyed writing about?
Oh, I enjoyed doing almost all of them, even the monstrous bits I quite enjoyed. So, you know, there were moments where I thought this isn't necessarily going to be other people's favourite kind of character in this book, but they very quickly occupied space. I mean, Danae is such a forgotten character in Greek myth. We sort of, you know, she's sort of the punchline, really, and sometimes Zeus manages to impregnate someone like this. And you're like, well, yeah. But imagine if that was a person. and so, you know, she's so sort of sweet and long-suffering, and so she is there's a very kind of passive element to her, which I felt like the narrative kind of required. But it does mean we have these sort of two versions of motherhood, of Danae to Perseus and then Cassiope to Andromeda. And these two versions, there are almost all the way through the book, there are relationships stalking other versions of themselves through the book. There are good and bad brothers, there are good and bad mothers, or different types of mother at the very least, from the absent to the really present, to the, you know, unable to age, to the unable to accept. And so those kinds of things were quite interesting, but I didn't think I'd really written about sisters in any great depth until this book. And so actually just writing the three Gorgons, writing Stheno and Euryale as well, it was just a delight, because it's a really particular kind of love I think siblings have for one another, even if, you know, they are older or more immortal and she is younger or more fragile, then it still isn't a maternal relationship. You know, they have a different response to her. And I really loved doing it. And there were other, you know, stories like the Graiai, you know, the three grey ladies, the spirits of the sea, who disgustingly to our minds share a single eye and a single tooth and take it in turns to insert one or both of these into their faces. You know, that was the first really kind of laugh out loud slash squeamishly cry chapter in the entire, and it was like, oh yeah, no, this is going to be a ball. But honestly, I really loved writing the Hesperides. Even though just deciding on the numbers was, you know, was, oh my God, could one source agree with one other source?
Never.
But I realized I had seen so many times variations on a scene of a man comes into a grove and there are naked ladies present, or some men come into a grove and there is a naked lady present. And, you know, there are some really beautiful artworks that describes some incredible Renaissance art, and there are some incredible artworks that noticed that's actually a bit creepy. I am thinking of Artemisia Gentileschi and the creepy old man watching. Is it Susanna? I think they're watching bathing. But the delight of taking that scene and switching it and saying, well, what would happen if there's a beautiful naked young man and a bunch of pervy girls just turn up and start laughing at him?
Steal his clothes, do the whole thing.
Yeah. I mean, they are basically mean girls. And why wouldn't they be? You know, that's the sort of perk of being them, I suppose. So yeah, there were scenes like that which were so much in dialogue with not just ancient myth, but more recent, only a classicist could refer to the Renaissance as recent, but you know what I mean, more recent reception of those myths. And to be able to say, all right, extremely, you know, sexist male artists of 500 years ago, what does it look like if a boy is in this position? It was just, I had a ball doing it.
Mm-hmm. No, I can imagine. And I, to go back to the Grey, I think I love them too much and am too sympathetic to them because it's funny, I didn't remotely feel any kind of squeamishness. I was just immediately like upset with Perseus. And I think you handled that so well, but also it made me so angry the way he handled it. And I was just like, good. I feel like, yeah, I mean, I definitely know that was the point and it worked, but I love them so much. They're so unique. It's one of my favorite things about Disney's Hercules that they conflate them with the Fates in a way that you get both of them in there. It's my favorite, but they are just so unique. And I absolutely love that their entire role in terms of surviving sources is just to do this one thing. And yet they have this fascinatingly wonderful single eye and single tooth. They're just so weird in such a unique way.
And you think they would have got loads of narrative, but again, this is what kept happening to me through this book. I was like, okay, so there's not that much on the Gorgons, but there's going to be loads on Danai. Okay, so there's not that much on the Gorgons or Andalai, but there's going to be loads about Andromeda. Okay, well, yeah, but the Graiai, right? Okay, well, but the Hesperides. Okay, so yeah, this is me the entire way through, like, right, I suppose I better write it then. So it was kind of joyous because, you know, the narrative sections on Athene are a bit more detailed, but even those are often quite glancing. You know, no one spends very long in ancient sources talking about motivation or things like that you need as a novelist. So it was an incredible journey of discovery, of finding these just glorious bits of myth, which sometimes I sort of felt like we really knew. But it's like, well, you're right. We know the Graiai from what? From Clash of the Titans, where they have a fantastic scene with Harry Hamlin, and from Disney Hercules. But I'm not sure they've had a huge role otherwise in my cultural life. And the reason is because there's almost no material on them. It's like, well, then I get to do this. I get to give them a voice, and that's going to be really good fun. So yeah, they are very squabbly, and I felt really conscious doing the audiobook of that I didn't have, you know, I couldn't give them each a different voice. It's like, well, they all lived in the same place, they can't have different accents, but man, they were funny to do.
They're just so fun. Like, they're really some of my favorites because they're just so unique in this great way. So yeah, big fan of the Graiai. I was very that was one of my favorite scenes, certainly, even if it ended horribly because Percy.
It's my way. I don't know what you want.
No, I mean, you did it well. Am I just that Perseus?
He gets paid back in the next bit.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, he's got some issues. Yeah. It's fine. Yeah. He doesn't have it easy, issues. At least. Yeah. No, but, and I did really appreciate too the relationship you gave Danae and her father, because I think a lot of the times, and I can't even think if it's in sourcing or just like sort of the way we've interpreted it, but it seems that he's often depicted as like evil for locking her away. And I think there's like a bit of added complexity there in your version that was nice to have versus a sort of like inherently evil means of locking her up. Not that it wasn't evil.
I mean, evil isn't interesting to write. So evil because scared, or evil because old age is frightening, or evil because not having old age is more frightening is just more fun to write. And the same with, you know, Poseidon, whose horrible self-regard is sort of pinned, this incredible vanity is pinned to this incredible insecurity when I write him, because it's like, well, I don't think it necessarily makes him more sympathetic, but I do think it makes him easier to understand. And when it's a novel, that's something which is important. You don't want just random agents of chaos wandering across the scene and being chaotic, because it would just be irritating after a while. So in quite a short while, I think. So it's like, well, why? But why? But why? And that's structuring this book is like dealing with my niece. She's like, but why does that happen? Yeah, hang on a minute.
I'll tell you.
Something up. Okay, this. Yeah. Why? One more second.
Yeah, that just reminds me too of the inclusion of Amphitrite was wonderful, because I feel like she's so often left out of almost everything that features Poseidon.
She was lovely to be able to do, because he is so, their relationship is quite opaque, Mm-hmm. And so I felt like she would be, well, you know exactly how she'll be, mm-hmm. that she would be both very quiet and at the same time deliberately opaque, because that's the only way to survive.
Yeah, I mean, if you're married to Poseidon, yeah, you've got a lot to deal with. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I usually ask if there's anything, you know, else that you want to share with my listeners or anything, but I also think we've covered a lot.
We have.
Yeah.
Well, you know, if you come up with any more questions,
I know.
We'll come back. We'll do the footnotes in a couple of weeks' time.
There's always so much. Like, I know I could talk about Medusa forever, but I will not force that upon anyone else. I do it enough on the podcast.
I've been talking here for 4 months on tour so far, because the book came out in the UK in September of 22. So yeah, I've been doing, I've talked about her for very many hours and it hasn't worn off yet. So
no,
yeah.
She's so fascinating for somebody who has almost no sources actually associated with her. I will finish this off by telling you, so I've sort of made it my case to like defend Medusa on the internet whenever she comes up. There was a time a couple years ago where she was like trending on Twitter really often for really weird reasons, and I was like, well, I'm going to wade into this because I love her and I, you know all of her sources. But I've heard some of the wildest things from men on Twitter when you're defending Medusa because of all this misogyny that we talked about, you know, that's been sort of placed upon her. But there were a couple of choice quotes that really stood out to me with the way that men have taken to seeing her. And I think a lot because of everything that surrounded her for the past couple hundred years. But one man told me that actually Perseus, his killing of Medusa was a necessary step, because her death alleviated like a pressure on the earth. Like, she was so evil that the earth was like required her death. And another said that she also needed death because she was terrorizing the lands, and like presented that as if that was a detail. It was so fascinating because I was like, neither of those things are remotely included in any of the ancient sources. Like, that's entirely invented. It's
what can you do? I mean, you know, if people are determined to find a monster, then they'll find one, I think. Generally my favorite is when Freud was engaging with the narrative, and his view was that her decapitation was a metaphor for castration. And it's like, dude, I don't know if you've noticed, she's technically female. It may not actually all be about your penis, professor.
And yet it's Freud. So
so, you know, but it's like, generally when you get this sort of mass of hair or snakes or anything like that, a labyrinth, anything where there's a sort of chaos of without a clear route through, it's generally taken to represent women's pubic hair rather than men's. And yet, you know, it's just sitting there going, well, this must all be about me. It's like, dude, I think if you check, you'll find she is the absolute metaphor for male fear of the female gaze. You know, it's that, it's literally being seen clearly by a woman you don't want to have sex with is the same as being turned to stone. It's completely disempowering. That's the only way, really, to read it. But well done on making it all about your genitalia. <It's> like, thank you for being so on brand.
Well, you know what? That's exactly the perfect way to end this, I think. And
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. And a perfect phrasing on what Medusa, you know, kind of actually represents. So I love that. Thank you so much for doing this. It's been so much fun to talk to you and about Medusa so specifically. I really appreciate
it. It's always my pleasure. I love joining you.
Oh, I'm so glad. It's such a thrill. Ugh, nerds. That conversation was so much fun. Like, gee, do you think I could talk about Medusa for the rest of my life and remain perfectly happy and content? Yeah, me too. This novel was so good, featured so much mythology beyond Medusa and gods. It's just great. It's great. Highly recommend. There are even very Greek snakes. Polyphidia. You can follow Natalie on the usual socials media and find her books in many regions. Remember, she's also written The Children of Jocasta about, well, The Children of Jocasta, and A Thousand Ships about the women of the Trojan War. Oh, that one's so good. And Pandora's Jar. Oh, man, that one's amazing. It's not a novel, but it's fucking fascinating. Oh, whew. Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is written and produced by me, Liv Albert. Michaela Smith is the Hermes to my Olympians and handles so many podcast-related things, from running the YouTube to creating promotional images and videos to editing and research. The podcast is hosted and monetized by iHeart Medusa. I wrote this too quickly, and I wrote Medusa instead of media. It is iHeart Media. Help me continue bringing you the world of Greek mythology and the ancient Mediterranean by becoming a patron, where you'll get bonus episodes and more. Visit patreon.com/mythsbaby or click the link in this episode's description. Thank you all for listening. Gods, these are fun to record. I am Liv, and I love this shit.
I'm Elliot Connie, and this is Family Therapy.
My best hopes, I guess, identify the life that I want and work towards it.
I never seen a man take care of my mother the way she needed to be taken care of.
I get the impression that you don't feel like you've done everything right as a father. Is that true?
That's true, and I'm not offended by that.
Thank you for going through those things, and thank you for overcoming them.
Thank God for the limits.
Every time I have like one of our sessions be positive. It just keeps me going.
I feel like my focus is redirected in a different aspect of my life now.
So, how'd we do today?
We did good.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy. Listen now on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV true crime podcast, To Live and Die in LA. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
iHeart Podcast Update. This week on your free iHeartRadio app. Fodor's Guide to Espionage, a 60s-era spy story of the world's first and greatest travel writer, Eugene Fodor, as he jet sets around the globe. Tongue Unbroken Season 2. This podcast explores complex concepts of identity, resilience, erasure, and genocide. Table for Two Season 2. Think of the show as a deconstructed Oscar party in podcast form. Each episode takes place over the romance of a meal and feels like you're seated next to a different guest at that dinner. Hear these podcasts and more on your free iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Get emotional with me, Radhi Devlukia, in my new podcast, A Really Good Cry. We're going to talk about and go through all the things that are sometimes difficult to process alone. We're going to go over how to regulate your emotions, diving deep into holistic personal development, and just building your mindset to have a happier, healthier life. We're going to be talking with some of my best friends.
I didn't know we were going to go there on this.
People that I admire.
When we say listen to your body, really tune into what's going on.
Authors of books that have changed my life.
Now you're talking about sympathy, which is different than empathy, right?
And basically have conversations that can help us get through this crazy thing we call life.
I already believe in myself. I already see myself. And so when people give me an opportunity, I'm just like, oh, great, you see me too.
We'll laugh together, we'll cry together, and find a way through all of our emotions. Never forget, it's okay to cry as long as you make it a really good one. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Radhi Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.